How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself?
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I think, write, speak, and live all things disruption. Today's guest is Karen Walrund. For those of you in the blogosphere, you may know her as Chukalunks. Based in Houston, Texas, but hailing from Trinidad and Tobago, Karen was formerly an engineer and attorney before disrupting herself to become an author and photographer. In 2016, she was on our 40 Women Over 40 to Watch list. Her latest book is Make Light. She also recently launched a podcast by the same name, where she features people whose mission it is to thrive out loud.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. I'm Karen Walrund, and I'm a writer and a photographer and an author. And most of my work has to do with finding your beautiful different and using it as your superpower, and also talking about what it means to thrive, particularly after 40.
Let's start off with the big question and really what piqued my interest about us having a conversation, which is about, I guess, 10 years ago or so, you made this huge career shift. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through what that shift was, what it looked like, and how people responded?
In my past life, I was a practicing attorney. I'm actually still an attorney. I keep my license active because you never know. But I was a practicing attorney. And, you know, it's so funny because, you know, this is such a long story. But as a kid, what I really wanted to be was an architect. That was my dream, to be an architect. But everyone around me told me that I was not artistic, that I wasn't a creative person. I wasn't an artistic person, but I was good at math. And so I ended up going to engineering school and realizing that I really didn't want to do that. So I ended up going to law school. So I was a practicing lawyer, and luckily landed in a gig that I really loved. I was a software lawyer. I negotiated multi-million dollar deals in the oil and gas industry. And I really, really loved it. It was a fun job. Mostly actually because of the writing, because I was writing contracts, and which it's funny because most lawyers look at me and go, that is the most boring part of practicing law. But I loved it. I would just stick my headphones on and write these contracts, and I loved writing them. So I was doing that, and I was really good at it. And unfortunately, when you're really good at something, they tend to promote you. And so I ended up being promoted to general counsel. Which is very prestigious and very wonderful, but it's a lot more stress because I don't get to write the contracts anymore. My lawyers who were working for me were writing them. And I was the one dealing with all the bad stuff, like if the contract went poorly, or, you know, if employees had a problem with each other, or we were getting sued or whatever. Like, I was basically the fireman. I was putting out fires, and it was really high stress for me. And I switched from that general counsel job to another smaller company as an assistant general counsel. And it really was just more of the same. And so I kind of decided that was it. I had a young daughter at the time, and I was working crazy hours, which I don't mind doing. I work crazy hours now, so it's not that. But I was working crazy hours at a job that I really didn't enjoy. I was getting what I now know were panic attacks. I didn't know at the time what was happening. I assumed I was just getting older. I was in my early 40s at the time. And I thought, could this be perimenopause? Like, what is happening here? But my heart would race even though I was lying in bed, and just really sort of weird stuff was happening. And so I thought, you know what, it's time to quit. During all this time, I'd been a photographer. I'd been, you know, as a hobbyist. And I thought, well, what would happen if I focused on that, even though I'm doing air quotes now, not an artist, and see what happens. And I never looked back. As far as how people reacted to it, my boss, who I had worked with for many years, I'd actually followed him from the first company to the second. You know, when I told him, I said, I'm leaving, he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know yet. I'm going to find something fun to do. and I'm going to work from home, and, you know, maybe I'll take some legal clients on the side, but I frankly don't think I will. And I actually never did. And he said, well, I think you'll be back. I think is what he said.
Oh, interesting.
He goes, I think you're going to be back. And I said, I really don't think I am. I said, no offense, I loved working for you, but I really don't think I am. And he said, no, you're too You're too gregarious, he said. You're too much of a people person. You're too smart, I think, is also what he said. You're too smart not to be back, which was vaguely insulting at the time. But I know he didn't mean it that way, right? Like I know he was trying to be encouraging. So I left and I didn't really know what I was going to do. I had been blogging for a while and the blog had had some success even without me trying because it was really not something I'd ever put my focus on, but it had a pretty good following and it was a photo blog primarily. And I knew I could write. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do? What if I focused on this? Like this is successful just kind of as a, you know, something I do on the weekends. What would happen if I focused on it and like really put my heart into it? And I remember thinking, what's my title? Like if I leave, what I have to have a title. Like who doesn't have a title? I have to have a title. And so, and I don't even know what I'm going to do. So I remember I sat down with my journal and I decided to make a list of everything I love to do, like everything, no matter how ridiculous or how mundane. Singing in the shower made it on the list and reading to my daughter made it on the list. I mean, like I literally put everything mm-hmm. on this list. And then after I exhausted it, I started going through and thinking, well, why? Like, what is it about like writing contracts that I love? And, you know, for me, like I said, it was taking something that was particularly complex and breaking it down so that anybody could understand what was going down. Because I that was something that was I was very passionate about was being a lawyer that didn't use legalese. And as I went through, I started seeing patterns. And the patterns were I love public speaking, which is something I've always loved. I love writing and I love shooting, speak, write, shoot. I love photography. Okay. And so I decided, you know what, that's what I'm going to do. I don't know what a person who does that is called, but that's what I'm going to do. And I made business cards and I didn't put a title on it. I just put speak, write, shoot on the card. Mm. And thought I'm good. And then I redid my site to make it clear that that's what I did. And I sat back and thought, let's see what happens.
Let's go back to you growing up and people telling you, you weren't creative. Like, where did that come from? What was the genesis of that? Cause clearly you were. So what was happening that people were they projecting onto you that they weren't creative, therefore you weren't, or what was happening?
I remember when I was in my 20s, my dad, you know, calling me into his home office and saying, here's all your documents from when you were a child. Like, I don't need these anymore. You're a grown up, right? Mm-hmm. Here's all your stuff. And he had every single like report card and medical document, everything about me. Like my life was in this thing. And I remember going through it and I found a report card from when I was in kindergarten. So maybe four or five. Mm-hmm. And the teacher wrote, Karen excels at English and math, but doesn't show any artistic ability. Right?
Oh.
So I probably couldn't draw or whatever. I don't know. I mean, at four, how do you know whether
it is? I have a dagger going through my heart right now. Those words, the power. Okay, keep going.
But you know what? I mean, like it was the 70s, right? It was ages ago. Teachers would never write that now. Right? It was a totally different time. And I think probably what happened after that was that because I was good at writing and math, everybody just sort of, you know, urged me to follow that, right? So
there's an important point here. Just tell our listeners briefly what your dad did as a profession and what your mom did, because that will help reinforce why people thought you were good at math and English.
Yeah. So my dad is a petroleum engineer. Mm-hmm. He has a PhD in petroleum engineering. And my mother was a school teacher. She actually did languages. My mother is sort of, my dad is like a math prodigy, like always mm-hmm. has been. He's amazing. And my mother is a languages prodigy. She can go anywhere and pick up a language. She speaks like five different languages. And she was a Spanish and French teacher, but they lived in Norway for a while and she's fluent in Norwegian. They lived in Azerbaijan for a while and she's fluent in Russian. So she's just kind of prodigious about that. So that's what they are. Neither artists. Neither of them were artists at all.
So for your teacher, that was sort of part of what people do is they look at what your parents do. And so anyway, I just think that's an interesting little theme there, or not theme, but just something to highlight of what they saw and what they were expecting that you could do. You say, all right, I've been doing this. I'm really good at the law. And now I'm going to do something else because I'm done.
Yeah.
And you discover that you're going to, what is it? Right?
Speak, right, shoot.
Speak, right, shoot.
Yep. Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. And you start doing it, and then what happens?
when I first started, I thought, oh, well, I'm a photographer. I'll do portraits or weddings. And I hated it. I was like, I love taking portraits, but I don't like taking portraits where that's the what people are hiring me for, because people get really crazy about their photographs, right? Like, could you remove the mole and can you make the wrinkles go away? And I'm like, no, your wrinkles are awesome. Like, I, you know, like, why would I make those go away? Right. So, so I was like, it was just a sort of soul crushing because I kept hearing what people hated about themselves. And so what ended up happening, of course, was that people would come to me and ask me these things and I would take it. And then I would like share that I'd done it. Right. So this, you know, I just got to write this really great article and go take this look, or, you know, take a look at this because it's a great publication. Or I had the opportunity to go speak at this organization and, you know, here's what I talked about and, you know, that kind of thing. And I started like sort of building a portfolio of work like that and sharing it online and, you know, beefing up my website so that it showed all of those things. And more work came. So it worked out really well for me.
Did you ever at any point have kind of struggle with your identity? When, I mean, you said you needed to figure out what your title was and you just wrote speak, write, shoot. Was there a moment where you went from being the lawyer to the speak, write, shoot that you were just like, what's my identity? Who am I?
Sure. I mean, like that whole exploration about it and putting speak, write, shoot on there was a little bit weird. And so, you know, people would look at them and go, well, what does that mean? You know, and I'd have to explain it. So absolutely, there were times when it was really difficult. I actually, now my latest card, I don't have anything on it. I just have my name. You know, I tend to change depending on where I am. So, you know, sometimes if somebody asks me what I do, I'm like, oh, I'm an author. Or, you know, sometimes I do a lot of public speaking and sort of on leadership. And, you know, I tell people that. So honestly, it changes depending on what the situation is and where I am. And I'm comfortable with it. I mean, I've been doing this now for a few years that I'm comfortable with it now. And I just think I'm a hyphenate. I mean, I just don't think that there's one thing that I could, I think saying, you know, saying Karen Walrond, you know, speaker is
doesn't
not enough,
it.
Right? Yeah. That's not everything that I do. And, you know, and I even tell people I'm still a lawyer because I do a lot of speaking at legal conferences and, you know, and leadership conferences for lawyers. So it just depends really.
So a few years ago, you wrote a book called The Beauty of Different, which is about 7 years ago now, but I think it's just the theme of it was what makes us unique also makes us beautiful, and it may also be the source of your superpowers. So you, as you said, you grew up in Trinidad, you then moved to Houston, I think when you were about 11 years old. And
that's right.
So what was the moment when you discovered that you were different?
Probably about when I moved from Trinidad to the US at 11 years old.
In the first nanosecond.
Yeah. So I moved here to Houston, which is where I live now. I moved to a suburb of Houston in 1978. So I was 11.
Okay.
And I had a funny accent, right? I spoke like a Trini. So I landed in Houston talking exactly like this, not sounding like, and this is a suburb of Houston, right? So everybody had these very Southern drawls and I didn't, right? I spoke like this and I had very short hair, right? I'm black, which the neighborhood we were in was like 99% white. And I had very short hair. I had a teeny weeny afro, a TWA, as we say. And I just stood out like a, you know, a sore thumb. And so, and it was the '70s, which was a lot, less of an enlightened time. So I had, you know, I had students giving me a hard time. I had teachers. I had one teacher who I will never forget, who was just horrible to me. And there was like, I think one other black kid in the school, and it was just a really, really tough time. Mm-hmm. But it was mostly a really confusing time because I didn't understand what the big deal was, right? You know, having not grown up in the US, having not really, been exposed to the history of the US,
the cultural
of, you
history,
know, understanding,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like knowing, you know, about the civil rights, you know, I just really didn't know. It just made no sense to me. And coming from a country where, you know, everybody was brown, like not everybody was black, but, you know, Trinidad is primarily South Asian and black and Asian and some white, and everybody's mixed, right? Like everybody's like, I have every shade in my family because every race mixed with each other. So, I just didn't stand out in Trinidad, right? I looked like a Trinidadian.
And then you came to Houston and you did.
And then I came here and not only did I look different, which I expected, people treated me different because of it, which made no sense because I had so many family members that didn't look exactly like me in Trinidad, and nobody, like, we were all Trinis. It didn't matter, right? Like, it's not a big deal. So I immediately started changing as much as I could. I drew my hair out. I straightened it. You know, I started wearing makeup, which I hadn't been doing. I got this, what I like to call CNN American accent that I'm speaking with now.
Where you can't really tell where from America I am, right?
They're so very flat.
Yeah, exactly. It's just sort of, where is she really from? You know, I couldn't do anything about being Black, but at least I looked more Black American. And then 2 years later, we moved back to Trinidad. And I look like a freak, right? Because I had this weird accent and my hair was straight. Not that, I mean, people straighten their hair in Trinidad, but, you know, it was just like, whoa, she went to America and tried to be American, right? And so then I cut all my hair off again and got my accent back and started speaking the way I was supposed to speak again. And, you know, and wore my school uniform.
Right, yeah, and all at this formative age, right, of a like prepubescent. Right. Like, so this is truly a formative experience for you. So. Right. One experience that I read about that I just thought was such a fantastic experience is when you first decided to try scuba diving. Would you share with our listeners what that experience was like?
Yeah. So I had decided, how did I decide to start scuba diving? I had a friend actually at this company that I was the staff attorney at. She actually was the travel manager for the attorney, for the company. And she came up to me and she was like, I'm thinking of getting certified in scuba. Do you want to join me? And I thought, well, I'm from the Caribbean. I should do this, right? Like, why not? And so, So we got certified together, right? And I am not a daredevil. I am not the person that loves, I hate roller coasters. I will never jump out of a plane. Like, you know, so this felt really daredevil-y to me, like to go, I'm going to get certified in scuba diving. But I'm a nervous diver. I love it, but it's very meditative. It, you know, because when you're, you know, under the water, it's quiet and all you hear are the bubbles and it's very peaceful and you have to breathe slowly so that you can conserve the oxygen in your tank. So what happened? We had gone on a dive together, our first dive together, and it was fine. But then I went to the Caribbean. That's what it was. I moved to London. After I got transferred to London, and then I decided to take myself on a vacation by myself back to the Caribbean, to Cayman Islands. And this is like maybe my third dive or fourth dive. Like, this is brand new diving. Yeah. And I'm a nervous diver, right? Like, I don't want to get, you know, bent, and, you know, like, I don't want to get all the things that they see. Like, once you become a certified scuba diver, you realize that the shark thing is actually the least of your worries. Like, you want to make sure you don't run out of oxygen, that you don't get too much nitrogen in your blood. Like, there's all these weird things that you have to keep watching dials and stuff and make sure that you're doing everything right. So I was having a hard time equalizing, which is getting the pressure out of your ear, because there's a lot of pressure as you go down further and further, and you have to clear your ears like you do on a plane in order to get down, or else you can blow an eardrum, which you don't want to see. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff about diving. So I'm having a really hard time getting down, and I'm telling the dive master, the guy who's taking the group of us down, that I'm having a hard time getting down. And it's Cayman Islands, which the water is like glass, like you can see anything, and it's teeming with life. And he says, okay, we go on the first dive, which was a very deep dive, and we get down to the ground. I mean, to the floor of the ocean. So we're at about 100-foot depth. And there's not a whole lot to see. There's some fish and stuff. There's not a whole lot to see, but I make it down. And I'm like, I'm so excited that I make it down. And he's like, okay, we're going to go to a trench. And I'm like, you know, he had told us this up, you know, on the boat. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. And so he says, okay, you know, he signals, follow me. And we follow. There's probably six of us. And we're going like in between rocks. So it's almost like kind of like a little, you know, like not a canyon, but like, you know, I'm up maybe a foot off of the seafloor going between these rocks. And then suddenly the floor just disappeared. Hmm. And we had reached the trench. And the trench was 25,000 feet, something like that. So you can't see the bottom anymore. Like, it was gone. It was just blue. And somehow going between these rocks out when the floor drops, there was some sort of like current or something, and it pushed me out over this trench. Mm-hmm. And it is the closest thing to flying I've ever felt, because suddenly there's no ground, right? And it's deep blue. And, you know, I turn and I look and I realize like I've just swum off a cliff face, basically, right? So I turn and look and see where I am. And the dive master, you know, he comes over and looks at me because he does, and he goes, are you okay? And gives the signal of okay. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm beyond it. Like, it was amazing. It was the most thrilling experience I had had at that point.
What switch flipped for you? Because you'd gone from being very cautious to all of a sudden, because when you first said you stepped off that cliff, I thought you were going to say you were terrified. And you said you were thrilled. Like, what happened?
I don't know.
It just happened.
It just happened. I mean, it just happened. I think, if you had told me what was going to happen ahead of time, mm-hmm. I would have freaked out. And there's some, it's funny you say that, because there's a lot that happens in diving that if you tell me on the boat, here's what's going to happen. You're going to go down there. You're going to see sharks. I'd probably be like, yeah, I'm not going down there. But then when you go down there and you see a shark, it's like, that is the coolest thing. Because all of a sudden it's almost like you're a guest in their world.
Yeah. You have another book coming up that's coming out on November 1st, 2017. Can you tell us a little bit about, it's called Make Light, Stories of Bright Sparks, Slow Burns, and Thriving Out Loud. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and the journey to go from The Beauty of Being Different to this book and sort of what's transpired in your life over the last 7 years that you want to dedicate this time and this energy and your sort of reputational capital to this topic?
Yeah. So what happened between the last book and this book is I got older. I wrote the last book, like you said, 7 years ago. So it came out when I was 43. In 13 days, I'm going to be 50. And
happy birthday.
Thank you. And I started actually, the book actually is a evolution of a photo project that I had done. I was kind of in the doldrums about my blog, and I feel like I'm writing 100% for an audience. Yet when I first started writing on the blog, it was really 100% for me. And so, I just don't have the passion around it that I did. I knew I didn't want to stop blogging, but mm-hmm. I was like, I need to kind of re-energize and reinvigorate that. And so I was, I mentioned this to a friend of mine, actually a friend who's much younger than me. I'm not even sure she's 40 yet. And she has a beautiful blog. Her name's Erin Lochner. She writes a blog called Design for Mankind. And it's just a beautiful, peaceful, lovely place on the internet. Mm. And I was talking to Erin about it. And Erin gave me this advice that when you hear it, you're going to be like, well, that's obvious, Karen. But for some reason, it really struck me. She said, Karen, you should write the content you wish you could read online. Mm. And I thought, that's really smart. And so I thought, well, when I was first writing, I was writing about becoming a new mom. That was the big reason. And that was sort of consuming me. But now my daughter's 13, or at the time she was 11. And I thought, it's not that I have everything down about mothering, but I kind of know where to get answers if I need answers mm-hmm. now, right? Like, it's not something that's,
you have the map consuming. Now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know what to do.
Yep.
Or how to find out what to do. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, what is it that I'm thinking about right now? And I thought, what I think about a lot is getting older. Because at the time I was 47, I think, at the time. And I thought, it wasn't that I was worried about getting older, because I've never worried about getting older. I've never had a problem about it. And actually, that was the point. I was like, I'm not seeing a lot of writing and content out there about the exhilaration of getting older, about how getting older is a really awesome thing. And yet my experience was, I was loving getting older. I felt stronger. I felt smarter. I felt more confident. I felt more secure in the person I wanted. I felt like I knew my values more and wanted to live them more and didn't really care if people thought that I should be living in a different way. And that was sort of the experience of my friends that were in similar ages. And so I started a photo project with an old Hasselblad camera, which is this lovely medium format camera that I have that's film, 100% film. And I thought, I'm going to take portraits of women who I think are thriving, that are over 40, and ask them, what does it mean to thrive? And I didn't know what I was going to get, right? Like, I was just like, I didn't put a call out. Like, there have been times when I've done photo projects and I put a call out and let anybody. I was like, no, these have to be people that when I look at them, I don't necessarily have to know them well, mm-hmm. but I look at them and think, that is how they look is how I want to feel. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that, and I want to really kind of. Mm-hmm. And so I had no idea what people would say. And what was wonderful about it is I was interviewing people who were just turned 40, who were, 50, who were 60. And their answers were really diverse. Like some talked about thriving as far as constantly learning, and some talked about thriving as far as moving through difficult times with grace and self-compassion. And some talked about thriving as being physically fit. Like everybody had kind of a different take on it. Some talked about thriving as having a closer connection to their God, right? Mm-hmm. So it was this huge like diversity. And I thought, you know what, there's a book here. And so that the book is Make Light. And I interviewed, and I have essays. It's very similar to my first book. There's some personal essays in it, but there's also a lot of interviews and a lot of people defining what thrive means. But it's focused on mind, body, spirit. And I my goal for the book was so that women who were 40 or older would look at it and go, wow, I have so much life yet to live. And that women who were younger than 40 would go, I can't wait to get to 40, right? Mm-hmm. Like, wow, mm-hmm. It's really beginning when it's 40. And I hopefully have done that. I feel like I have.
Mm. You know, as you may recall, so you were on our 40 women over 40 to watch list last year. Mm-hmm. And I'm happier. I'm even more happier than ever because you are not only a woman to watch, but you are highlighting women to watch and just showing just the beauty. Ashton Applewhite, you're probably familiar with her. She writes a blog called This Chair Rocks. And she talks about how when you get over a certain age, whether it's 40 or 50, it's you're not more old, you're just more. And I just think that that's such
I love that.
Isn't that beautiful? It's just a wonderful way to describe it. And so I'm so excited for you. And question to you is, how do you define thriving?
I think there's two parts. I think one part is thriving means really being very clear on whose opinion matters. Mm-hmm. That the number of people whose opinion matters is a really, really tiny number. That and then living your life, right? So letting go of expectations and what the world wants you to be, because that's just bogus. Like that's just ridiculous, right? Yeah. So that's one part of it. I think the other part of it is searching for, I don't want to say balance because I hate that word, but searching for...
Why do you hate that word?
Because I think balance means that you're going through life, like every day of
teetering.
Your life, you are, or you're just every day of your life, you're getting as much family time as possible and you're doing really great at work and you're working out and you're praying to your God and you're, you know, like you've got all of that in one day. And I honestly don't think that's possible on one day, every day.
Okay.
And I don't think that's possible. I think sometimes you're going to have really great family days, right? But it means that you're not going to be looking at work. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're going to have to focus on work and maybe your kids and your partner are going to have to, you know, kind of fend for themselves while you get through this work part. And sometimes you're going to be out there hiking forever. And then sometimes you're not. Like, I think that's, I think there's like an ebb and flow to all of it. Mm-hmm. But I think thriving is being mindful of that, like being mindful of, you know what, I know this is a work time. So at some point I need to get back to spiritual time. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing really great spiritually, but you know what? At some point I need to get back to family or whatever. Like, I think mm-hmm. it's sort of thriving is being mindful of that.
Got it.
Taking care of those things over time, those three things. And because you do that, that when the hard times come, and they will, that you're able to move through them with more grace and more self-compassion and more, perspective, I think, because I think doing all three of those things can help you get perspective. Plus, I also think this is a bonus. I think a thriving gratitude practice will get you there in a lot of it, because I think gratitude is the key to joy. I really do.
Agreed. 100%. So how will you disrupt yourself in the next 12 months?
Yeah. You know, I love this question and I've been thinking about it so much because I am turning 50 and it's such a milestone mm-hmm. age mm-hmm. That I've been thinking like, okay, my grandparents all lived into their 90s and one lived to 102. So the way I figure it, I've got my life again to live, right?
You got a lot more
which is
living
a whole
to do.
Lot of potential. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a couple of things that I've been thinking about. One is I feel in a lot of ways that I've gotten very comfortable with my work. I know how to give a keynote and do a great job. I know how to take a photograph and do a really good job. And I kind of want to push myself. I'm really interested in like video and cinematography. So I'd love to creatively, I'd like to start doing more of that. Just experimenting with it like I did with photography 20 something years ago and see what comes of it, because I think that could be really fun. You know, and also maybe doing some more workshops, doing stuff that really, that it's, instead of having people hire me to speak, like actually creating events.
You create
where
we
could
events.
Do that. Yeah.
Okay,
so that I can do that and invite people and, and do some stuff like that. So I hopefully I'll be doing more of that. I think that would be really interesting and fun. And then, you know, I got a book tour coming up, so, you know, I'm sure, you know, I'll be doing a lot of stuff on that. And then, you know, one of the things that I, you know, my friend Brené Brown, so she's actually a good friend of mine. And one of the things that she said,
just once, let it be noted, I love her work. So.
Oh, good.
It must be brilliant. Said. Okay. So keep going.
Yeah. She's brilliant. She does brilliant work. You know, she's a researcher on courage and authenticity and shame. And we were talking once, and in passing, I don't even remember what we were talking about, but she said the phrase legacy work. Right. And I loved that phrase. And really kind of figuring out what my legacy work should be for the next 50 years. Like, what is the stuff that I can create that is of service, and that helps make women stronger primarily, but people stronger generally, and of all races and gender orientations and religions, because inclusivity is a huge passion of mine. And not just because I feel like, well, I don't want to be excluded anymore, but I feel like there is strength in diversity, and we get innovation comes from diversity and creativity comes from diversity. And that only happens if everybody feels included, and feels celebrated. And if there's a way that I can use my work to help celebrate and include more diverse people in my work, I definitely want to do that.
So Karen, thank you so much for spending this time with me and with our listeners. I know they're going to love hearing what you have to say, and I'm so excited for your next book, and thank you again.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So, so much here. First of all, did you notice how Karen knew when she was on the wrong learning curve? She started to get sick. It's usually a pretty good sign it's time to jump. Once she decided to try something new, as with scuba diving, it wasn't terrifying, though she thought it would be, but in fact thrilling. Karen has also been very discovery-driven. She wasn't sure what she would offer the world, like with Speak, Write, Shoot, but she started, believing that if she would keep iterating, she would figure it out, and she has. Change is not linear. I repeat, change is not linear. Elevator pitches make it sound that way, but it isn't. We're pretty good about not expecting our own story to be linear. Let's give others the same luxury at home and at work. Finally, isn't it exciting that Karen's going to make a short film? There's nothing quite like saying a dream out loud to make it come alive, or in Karen's words, to thrive out loud. For a list of people, places, publications mentioned in this podcast, there are links in the show notes at whitneyjohnson.com. If you'd like a transcript of this interview, it's available to our newsletter subscribers. Thank you to all of you who have been writing in, like Brian Moran. He was an early guest, episode 3, and now is a kind and generous, even enthusiastic supporter. Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you also to Karen Walrond for being our guest today, to sound engineer Kelsey Peters, editor Heather Hunt, editor and show notes contributor Macy Robinson, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.